Hi, welcome to Neuroverse, a podcast hosted by Carolina
and Clara, where we discuss all matters from neuroscience to philosophy and beyond. So the topic of today's episode is protein dysregulation in neurodegenerative disorders, and we are joined by an expert in the field, Dr. Estella Newcomb. Estella holds a bachelor's degree in biotechnology and chemistry from the University of Queensland and a PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology from the University of Melbourne, where she studied the interactions and structures of the protein whose mutations cause Huntington's disease, the Huntington protein. She subsequently worked as a postdoctoral fellow at the Queensland Brain Institute studying the structures of intrinsically disordered proteins before taking up her current role as a Marie Sklodowska-Curie Fellow at the University of Copenhagen, where she is working in the structural biology and NMR laboratory and continuing research on intrinsically disordered proteins. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us today, Estella.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, we're excited to hear about your research today. So why don't we start the episode by you explaining a bit about what your research interests are and what exactly you are currently researching?
Yeah, so I've kind of been, I guess, a bit of jack of all trades with respect to neurodegenerative disease causing proteins. I started off working on Huntington in my PhD and then moved on to working on the proteins that cause Alzheimer's disease. And then now I work on the protein that causes Parkinson's disease. And so I've kind of gone between like a lot of this basic structural biology, so looking at the exact structures of the proteins and how they interact, all the way through to like mouse models and some, you know, human tissue with Alzheimer's disease. And now I'm mostly like working with the structural biology again, looking at how Parkinson's disease causing proteins interact with other things and whether that increases or decreases pathology.
That sounds really interesting. And I guess the fact that you've kind of switched between these different neurodegenerative disorders, is there quite like a common mechanisms that underlie these disorders in terms of the protein structure level?
Yeah, exactly. Like you mentioned, the intrinsically disordered proteins. So this is like a real, you know, fundamental thing about proteins is their structure. I think, you know, I guess in the grand scheme of things, it was only pretty recently that people discovered that proteins could also not have a typical structure. So they are not in this alpha helical or this stacked sheet structure. They can actually just kind of be flopping around all over the place. And that still gives them a function. They're not, you know, useless because of that. And some proteins stay like that even when they're interacting, and some proteins form structure when they interact. And one of the key things about neurodegenerative disease proteins is that all of them have this disorder. They have this intrinsic disorder when they're monomeric, when they're by themselves, but during the pathological, you know, event or when the protein is pathogenic, they actually start to accumulate together and form these higher order structures where basically you have the monomer, the single protein, coming together with a bunch of other stuff as well as more of itself and forming these big solid aggregated clumps within the cell or even outside of the cell in the case of like, you know, amyloid beta for Alzheimer's disease. And so, yeah, there are real fundamental structural, you know, things about proteins that cause neurodegenerative diseases. And that's kind of my main interest, I guess, in research.
That's really interesting. And I wasn't that aware that sometimes these intrinsically disordered proteins can then, I guess, aggregate and form these clumps. I was wondering, so what is the discourse regarding intrinsically disordered proteins in the sense of, yes, they do still have a structure and a function. Does this mean that their intrinsically disordered property make them all potentially pathogenic or complicit with neurodegeneration? Or is there also some utility for it and some benefits to it?
It's definitely not like going to implicitly cause any problems. There are like a lot of proteins that are intrinsically disordered or have intrinsically disordered regions. you know, I think that one of the numbers that is usually floated around is about 30% of the proteome has this sort of intrinsic disorder. Whether that's still 100% true or not is debatable, but that's kind of the main number that gets floated around. There are lots and lots of proteins that have this disorder. I think what's interesting is that all of the proteins that cause neurodegeneration do have it as well. It's basically, if you think about a protein, the structured proteins are kind of set in their structure. They have that and they're floating around like that. Whereas the disordered proteins, it's not that they don't form structure, it's that they're super, super dynamic. So they move around a lot. They're kind of like a strand of pasta in a pot, like it's just like moving around constantly as the water is boiling. So it's sort of like this dynamic thing. It can incidentally form transient structure, but like usually it's just very dynamic and moving around a lot. And this can then maybe lead to some functions, like they might be able to move around and sort of form hinges or like links between other proteins, or maybe it helps with their interactions. For example, I'm also really interested in how proteins interact with RNA. And so I think intrinsically disordered proteins can interact with RNA like very easily, and they don't necessarily need any kind of motif. They don't need an exact sequence to do so. So it's quite interesting. It gives them a lot of these sort of very variable abilities within the cell. I think it's very cool. So yeah.
I'm loving how much this relates to like one of our biggest themes throughout Neuroverse from the beginning of when we started this podcast has been structure and function relationships. And we always talk about like how on top of having a structure and a function, you also have dynamics between different proteins or molecules or neurons across scales, really. Mm. And like here, this is a perfect example of how structure influences the dynamics that can be had, which influences function. And yeah, I'm loving it. And I like the pasta example.
Yeah.
I think it's a great way to visualize it.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to conceptualize, you know. I think especially you just think, oh, well, it's intrinsically disordered. That means it just doesn't have a structure. I mean, it can kind of form some structures. It's just that it's moving around so dynamically that you can't actually, you know, trap it in one particular, you know, structure, I guess, which makes the structural biology aspect quite interesting because it eliminates a lot of the, you know, typical structural biology techniques like X-ray crystallography. You can't really use that for these proteins because they don't just form that one structure that you can make a crystal and then like it's a snapshot, right? So it's not exactly useful in this situation.
So what sorts of techniques do you use to study these intrinsically disordered proteins?
I think structure, like if you really want to get down into the structure, you really need to start using a technique like NMR. So that's nuclear magnetic resonance. It's kind of, I guess, you know, using these giant magnets and shining like a pulse sequence through. It gets very technical and very biophysical, so we don't need to get too much into it. But it basically means that you can look at these very dynamic proteins and get a good idea of not just their structure or, you know, like the sort of summary of their structure if they're so dynamic, but you can actually look very closely at different timescales of how dynamic they are. So say if it's they're moving around, you know, within the microsecond or nanosecond kind of range, or which part of the protein is dynamic? Is it the backbone of the protein? Is it the side chains and things like this? You can actually get into a lot more detail, and you can get a lot more information out of it using NMR, which is a very useful technique in this field. Yes.
Cool. Continuing on the topic of methods and techniques, do you think that NMR is sufficient, or do you believe that we need more novel techniques to be able to decipher a bit better the structure of the proteins?
I mean, I think in the case of intrinsically disordered proteins, NMR is very, very good. We also have things like single molecule FRET, where you're looking basically at two different sides of a protein and how close they come together using fluorescence. So that's maybe a little technical, but it's a newer kind of technique, and you need these sort of, you know, big microscopes and things like that to use that. But that's also very useful in getting the dynamics of the protein. Yeah. And then I think, you know, you can use NMR in a lot of different ways. So I think that's quite a good thing. One of the more interesting things with structural biology, though, as well, like, you know, we have this AlphaFold technology now, which is a very useful thing for people who are not necessarily structural biologists. If you just put your protein into the AlphaFold server, it will give you a structure out based on a lot of AI kind of things. But what's interesting for these disordered proteins is that it will basically just say, oh, for this region, I have no confidence that what I'm telling you is correct. And that's when we, as like, you know, disordered proteins researchers, are just like, oh, well, that region's probably disordered, because the AI is not really, I guess, suited that well for predicting these disordered regions. So it still leaves us a little bit of wiggle room as structural biologists. When it first came out, I was like, are we going to have a job? But actually, like, for the disordered proteins, it's actually quite interesting the way that it sort of is. There's still a big gap there with AlphaFold. So
yeah, I wanted to ask, do you think AlphaFold is enough? Do you think we need stronger models or algorithms? And do you think we'll get to that point where we'll be able to have something that can even predict the disordered proteins?
I think that we probably will be able to predict that there's a disordered region. Whether we can predict then the dynamics of that region, I think, is questionable, at least for the near future. But of course, anything's possible. AI is already, you know, challenging what we even think a program can do, I guess. So let's see. But I do think the dynamics is a lot more difficult for you to predict, even as a researcher. You know, like, we've had these prediction tools for a long time. AlphaFold just really, like, almost perfected them, I suppose, in a way. Maybe not perfected, but, you know, made them a lot better. But for the disordered proteins, I think there's a huge range of things that we need to do experimentally.
I really like this idea of, like, using the uncertainty of the AI to understand the probability of something being disordered. And it's kind of just gave me this picture of disordered proteins in general as, like, viewing them in a statistical way, like the probability that they are to form structures with other molecules or proteins, and the probability that they are to be disordered versus ordered. And have you ever thought about neurodegeneration as, like, this is kind of an abstract idea, sorry. It's just, do you ever think of neurodegeneration as sort of like an increased probability of something going wrong? You know, like, because there's just more disorder. And have you ever related this to neurodegeneration as occurring more in humans, where there's, like, more complexity and more statistical variability in how proteins act? Do you have any thoughts on this?
I think that that's a good point. I think that the disorder probably does increase the chances of things going wrong just a little bit, maybe not 100%, but, you know, I think just them being so dynamic, it might increase the chances of them interacting with something that maybe is not necessarily good for that particular, you know, protein to interact with, for example. The flexibility of the protein perhaps does increase that chance. But whether or not that's exactly what happens is still, you know, quite debated, I think, in the field. And even the process of aggregation, I think, is still quite, people love to talk about why it happens, but no one has any concrete, you know, everyone has their pet theory, right? So it's quite difficult to pin down. As for, like, whether we kind of evolved to have more disorder or this kind of thing, I'm not 100% sure on, like, the evolution of the disordered proteins, whether or not we started with lots of them and then ended up with very few. This is all very difficult to analyze because, you know, for example, in bacteria, there are almost no disordered proteins. Is that because bacteria evolve so fast that they've moved away from disordered proteins, or are we more evolved because we have disordered proteins? Very, very difficult to pin down because you need so many historical samples that it's just not available. One really interesting thing, though, with Huntington's disease. So in Huntington's disease, it's pretty much the only, or one of the only, genetic neurodegenerative diseases. So it's basically a dominant disease. So if you have the gene, you will have the disease. It's not recessive at all. And so that's a really nice model disease to work with, because a lot of the other neurodegenerative diseases are sporadic and people don't know exactly what triggers them. But the reason for Huntington's disease is that it has this sort of, the protein is sort of one length in most people, but it becomes elongated and you have this repeat sequence of the amino acid glutamine. And you have like anyone with above 36 glutamines within their Huntington protein is probably going to get the disease. Anyone with above 39 will definitely get the disease. So it's a very clear cutoff with that. What's really interesting is if you look at other animals with the Huntington protein, they actually have very, very few repeat sequences. So the theory there is that this repeat sequence has sort of like been evolved. And there are a lot of other proteins where that's true as well, where you have like very short repeat sequence in sort of lower order organisms. And then in humans and higher order organisms, you have like this very, very long repeat sequence. And so that seems to be something that is associated with evolution and complexity. And certainly that leads to a much more disordered protein as well. So it's a complicated question, and I hope the answer wasn't too complicated, but I think it's a very interesting point. And there is obviously something there, but it's difficult then to discern exactly what that means.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. And I really liked the use of that example. But I was wondering if you carry out your research in animal models, or do you, like, how do you, where do you get these proteins from when you're looking at them under these complex microscopes?
Yeah, so I have previously worked on animal models, but at the moment, when you're just looking at the proteins using the magnets or the microscopes, then you're really just using recombinant protein. So in that case, you get to make it in bacteria, and it's quite fast. To get the proteins from animals, you are not able to get the concentrations really that you need. When it comes into like cell models or animal models, that's sort of more like if you wanted to look at how the protein is interacting in a cellular model. Whereas we kind of have, you know, we draw from research that has used that, and then we say, oh, it looks like it's probably interacting with these other proteins. Then we purify both our interested protein and maybe its interacting partner. And then just as, you know, alone, we can interact those together and see if that interaction does proceed and how it proceeds and how that affects structure and that sort of thing. So you really need to, for this kind of technique, really isolate those proteins out of, you know, bacteria, where you can tell them to make like a ton of it and they will. So yeah,
that's kind of weird for me to hear as a neuroscientist, because we're always like so aware of making sure our model at least represents the system we're studying somehow. So like everything, it's always better when it's, you know, in vivo, like in an actual brain, or at least, you know, an organoid or something, like a system that has a circuit in place. So like isolating the proteins and being able to study in that much detail is kind of strange to me, but nice. Like that you just reduce it down to that.
Yeah. And I think for me, you know, like, so before I did my PhD, I worked a lot on neurogenesis actually. And I always got stuck on like the mechanism question. You know, people are always like, oh, cool, you found this thing in cells or in mice, but what's the mechanism? And I was like, oh, you know, I'm like a little naive student. I'm like, I have literally no idea how to answer that question. So that's where I went more into like the biochemistry, molecular biology kind of field, and to these more sort of simple systems, I guess, where you can isolate the protein out and understand how exactly it's interacting with other things. And so then having that knowledge of both, you know, the very simple to the animal models, I think is a really like interesting way to look at neuroscience, because like you can really get down into those mechanistic details in a way that you probably, I mean, it is quite difficult to do that in mice, for example. So I think it's kind of a nice, like sort of broad spectrum of understanding how things work, I guess, in the brain.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of people criticize a reductionist approach, but I think sometimes it makes a lot more sense, like fully making use of that reductionism and isolating the system to properly understand it, rather than like pretending that you're reducing and in the system as a whole at the same time, and then there are just too many factors involved. And yeah, I kind of relate to you in terms of always wanting to understand the mechanism, which is something that's always a battle as like a molecular, cellular, sometimes systems neuroscientist. But yeah.
Yeah, my undergrad is in biochemistry. And so I was also very much, I had a very strong mechanistic background and way of thinking, and very much, okay, this is the structure, therefore what's the function? And then we actually had an episode on different planes of understanding where Clara and I did compare our experiences as Clara as a neuroscientist and mine as a biochemist, in terms of like, sometimes I would struggle to look just beyond the mechanism. And because with neuroscience, there's so many levels that you need to take into account in. And I feel like there's criticisms with both models, both with reducing it and just looking at the mechanism, and also just working with like a whole animal model and taking into several different factors, not only the genetic lines, whether or not it's histologically relevant, et cetera, et cetera. And so I do quite miss the quote unquote simplicity, just in the sense of biochemistry, in the sense of like, this is the one little protein I'm working with, and I don't need to worry about all of these other extrinsic factors for now. Yeah. So we spoke a little bit about evolution and how these differences in bacterial proteins versus mammalian proteins. And we had an episode on structure function relationships, and I was questioning why is it that given that we have, given everything is so either evolutionarily conserved or everything is optimized energetically, etc., why is it that we're still having post-translational modifications happening on our proteins? Like, if the primary sequence of amino acids codes for the secondary structure, the tertiary, quaternary structure, why is it that so many proteins still suffer post-transcriptional modifications? And I was wondering what your opinion is on that. And also, I was hoping to get a bit more of an insight into what you think is the impact of phosphorylation in intrinsically disordered proteins, according to your paper.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I do have a paper on that. Yeah, so I think phosphorylation, I mean, to me, it's like, not really that the protein is, you know, suffering from this. I think it just really like improves the toolkit of what that protein is capable of. So it's kind of like, I mean, I see it almost, maybe, I don't know if I should, like the almost like methylation, right, with epigenetics. So that's, you know, you have your genetic code, you have things that can turn it on and off in a way that doesn't actually affect the genome. I kind of sort of think of phosphorylation in that way, where, you know, you're really improving the toolkit of that protein, and, you know, improving how it can interact. Like maybe a protein is not functional without the phosphorylation. So, and then with respect to intrinsically disordered proteins as well, it can have a huge effect on the protein structure and what it can interact with. And that's mainly because you're changing the charge of the protein. So you're increasing its charge, and then you will have its ability to, say, interact with like calcium or something like this, which will be enhanced. So I think that it's a very necessary sort of tool to have for proteins, that they can be changed in a way that doesn't actually affect their core sequence. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a necessary thing. I think it's probably pretty good. With respect to neurodegenerative diseases, not so much. I mean, you have tau, for example, for Alzheimer's disease, which is hyperphosphorylated, that actually causes it to sort of form these tangles and aggregates during neurodegeneration. And I think phosphorylation of alpha-synuclein has also been found to be quite pathological. So I do think that it's quite an interesting thing, and we definitely can't just, you know, not think about phosphorylation. We have to think about it in the sense that it happens in the cell. So if it happens in the cell, then we also need to think about it like in the test tube. So it's definitely something that we look into a lot. Yeah.
Yes, I can understand how it can have a lot of advantages in terms of like expanding the protein's toolkit. But I was wondering what your opinion is in terms of why don't the proteins already have the structure they need to have in order to carry out their function? Like, why run the risk of having the availability of them undergoing post-transcriptional modification, which can either be beneficial or lead to like more severe consequences in terms of neurodegenerative diseases? Like, why run that risk? Do you think it's evolutionarily advantageous?
Whether it's evolutionary, like I think it, as a whole, I would say yes, it is. Say, for example, if a protein is only active when it's been phosphorylated, I think that that's the sort of the cell's way of really controlling the activity of that protein. You know, I think that the process of making the protein is so much slower than just phosphorylating it, right? So if you want to have that protein around, it has a function, but you don't necessarily need it right in this instant. And then you have some event that causes you to need that protein to be active. Phosphorylating it is much, much faster than producing the protein right from, you know, transcription translation. I think in that case, it is very much, you know, advantageous to have these proteins that can sort of be turned on and off like much more quickly. But yeah, I mean, obviously there are times when it makes the protein not so healthy. And I think what's really interesting then is to actually go back and look into, you know, what was the evolutionary purpose of hyperphosphorylation, for example? Like, why would it ever do that? That I do not know.
This episode is kind of making me want to change field into the evolution of proteins.
I know. Yeah. We're thinking about it a lot in our lab actually lately. So it's a huge question and it's so difficult because you can really only speculate, right? Like it's extremely difficult to get any data on this.
Yeah. And I like the way you said, why would it ever do this? It's so funny for us as like humans, like
questioning nature, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Questioning like years and years of finely tuned evolution and just like, this doesn't make sense.
But it also like raises the question of like how finely tuned is evolution? Like it kind of, it's almost one of those things of like coordinated falling, I think, where like, oh, I found the fastest, easiest way to make this thing work and I will never change from that, even though it's actually like not actually that efficient. So yeah, I think evolution is a very strange thing to look into. And I think it's a cool question. Yeah, we have some new papers that'll come out kind of soon that have sort of some impact on this, but it's definitely, it's a little further removed from neuroscience.
That's still super exciting though. We'll be sure to check them out when they're out. Mm-hmm. Going back slightly to when we were speaking about phosphorylation and post-translational modifications, you mentioned methylation as being influenced by environmental factors that can lead to methylation.
Yeah, I think it's methylation of like DNA, right? So that's the that's like the epigenetics kind of thing rather than post-translational modification. Yeah.
Thanks for clarifying. Yeah. So like DNA methylation, I wanted to ask as well if, because I noticed some of your papers reference how environmental factors influence the pathogenesis of neurodegenerative disorders, like inflammation and metal toxicity in Alzheimer's disease. And it's interesting that you're coming from the protein-protein level perspective. So could you tell us a bit about what the evidence is for these environmental influences leading to neurodegeneration at the protein level?
Yeah, so at the protein level, I think that, I mean, I would say that the inflammation and that sort of thing is more like protein-protein interactions that can kind of affect, you know, these neurodegenerative proteins. And this would be looking at it more from like a systemic viewpoint where you have like an event that happens to the body, inflammation is increased, and then that can either like speed up or, you know, reduce other things that happen to proteins. So in that case, usually inflammation that happens is then releasing all of these cytokines into the body. And that, you know, if even if the inflammation is like, say you have like diabetes or something like this, it can increase the overall inflammation in your body. And then having all of that inflammation, having all of these, you know, cytokines, which are also proteins, can then speed up how quickly Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative diseases progress. So people, this is still being like very heavily researched as well. I think that there's still some debate about how exactly those cytokines are interacting with the proteins, or even if they are, you know, directly, or if it's an indirect effect. Basically, you know, any inflammation can really increase the speed of Alzheimer's disease, for example. So the proteins aggregating is one of the markers that people would use there. Yeah. On a protein level, I think I don't 100% know exactly, like with respect to any post-translational modifications or anything. I would have to look into it. But yeah, I think that in general, inflammation is really a key driver of disease, not just neurodegenerative, but a lot of diseases. Yeah.
Yeah. And how is it in terms of like the relationship between inflammation and neurodegeneration in terms of susceptibility? So if you have more disordered proteins, then are they more likely to be influenced by inflammation? Or is it like, you know, the other way around where inflammation increases disorder somehow?
Yeah, so it's not so much going to affect the prevalence of the disordered proteins at all. They're kind of just there and just doing their normal thing. Most of them are totally, you know, innocuous. They're not doing anything wrong. They're just like doing their normal functions. And so, you know, just the just having more of them won't probably lead to any issues. But when it comes to inflammation, if you do have like susceptibility to have a neurodegenerative disease, say you have a mutation in one of the proteins involved, then having more inflammation in your body can increase the chances that that protein is going to behave, you know, in an incorrect way, start to aggregate or start to become toxic. So just, yeah, the fact that they're disordered, I don't want like to malign disordered proteins. They're not, inherently bad or anything. It's just that they can, you know, turn bad when you have like these other impacts on them. And when they're in this sort of very specific situation that causes their aggregation, and exactly, again, like what that situation is still technically not really known, so it's quite difficult to pin it down. Inflammation is so interesting though, because it's involved in so many different diseases, and it's almost like a vicious circle when it comes to neurodegeneration, because you know, the aggregated proteins actually can cause more inflammation, which then in turn can cause more aggregated proteins. And it's quite you know, a difficult thing to address, because I mean, a lot of the drugs, for example, for Alzheimer's disease have tried to focus on inflammation and have failed. So exactly what is going on there is like a very, you know, hot question, I would say.
Yeah, very interesting. I wanted to ask whether localized environmental changes like pH or ionic strength influences phosphorylation events, and whether this can contribute to pathogenic states. And the reason why I asked this question is because we recently had an episode on biomimetics and how there's some really cool technology about delivering drugs or other nanoparticles to specific desired action sites that can then potentially address the environment or the misfolded protein. And do you think that this could be a potential therapy? And what is your opinion on localized environment and potential therapies addressing protein misfolding?
Yeah, I mean, I think that could be really interesting. A lot of the different neurodegenerative diseases have like a quite localized start, like in, you know, one part of the brain versus the other. And so if you were able to target neurons from, say, for example, the hippocampus versus neurons from the amygdala, that would actually be very helpful. When it comes to, yeah, like pH and this sort of thing, yeah, you definitely need a bunch of conditions for phosphorylation to occur. So you often need some accessory like ions like calcium, which is also very important for signaling in the brain. So that's a very important thing, usually for the phosphorylation of proteins. So yeah, you definitely need the conditions to be correct for that kind of signaling to occur. Yeah.
And do you think that there's any interesting technologies or therapies coming up that could potentially address protein misfolding problems or aid in slowing down neurodegeneration?
Maybe. I'm quite far removed from the treatment aspect of this. And certainly more what you hear is just drugs failing, and they'll get to like stage three and then everything will fall down. Or even if they get like, even if they get released, you know, they barely do anything. A lot of it is just treating the symptoms. I think that until we get like a really good way of diagnosing the diseases before people actually, you know, have Alzheimer's disease in their brain for 10 years before they're like showing any symptoms, for example, like what are you meant to do at that stage? It's quite difficult. You can definitely treat the symptoms and try to help with like reducing any further neurodegeneration. But it is actually quite a difficult thing when you think about how long the disease has progressed up until that point. So with respect to drugs, I think that the anti-inflammatories have promised, but that has not been met yet, I guess. People haven't really had that much luck with them, but perhaps that's just that they're targeting the wrong thing. So maybe you're targeting one type of cytokine, for example, and you actually need to be targeting a different one and this sort of thing. So as far as I think the research has progressed significantly and we are learning and learning a lot. And as tools for understanding and tools for diagnosing improve, I think that's when we'll start to see real changes in sort of the outcomes for people who have neurodegenerative diseases. Yeah.
Yeah. And linked to that, like I am fairly aware of the issue in terms of like proteins involved in neurodegeneration, of which form of the protein is actually the toxic one, because I like it was at undergraduate level only, but we had to do this debate about amyloid beta protein in Alzheimer's and which form of the protein is actually the toxic one. Is it the monomer or is it the oligomer? And so is this still a huge debate in across neurodegenerative disorders?
Yeah, I guess it would probably, yeah, you could say that. My PhD thesis was actually kind of trying to address this with respect to the Huntington protein. So initially when I started, we were like, oh, there has to be a different structure for the pathogenic version, and that's why it's toxic. And so we went in with the premise that it was the monomer and that the monomer was causing, you know, toxicity via a slightly different structure than the, you know, non-pathogenic version of the protein. But actually what we found is that the proteins are extremely similar in structure. So it was not forming a separate toxic structure, but what it was doing is that it sort of formed this like, I guess, tadpole-like thing where you have like a lot more interaction within the sort of start of the head of the protein. And then the tail was still doing the exact same thing in both of the proteins. So it was not a different structure necessarily, but the dynamics of the structure were different. So I think that was a very interesting sort of insight, I guess, into, okay, yeah, it's maybe oversimplifying things just to say that there's a toxic structure and that does everything. Actually, what we found is that, you know, it can still have all of these pathogenic properties, but still be a relatively similar protein structure. And that's not an easy answer, right? Like, it's kind of annoying. So I don't know. I think there's a lot still to be understood about how the protein structures and lack of structures really affect the disease.
Yeah, I mean, but that's a really important point. And it also like justifies what we were saying at the beginning of the episode of using technologies like NMR and FRET to look at the protein-protein interactions. And maybe as humans, we're too prone to categorizing things and just wanting to find one simple answer. And like, oh, if we could just find like whether it's the monomer or the oligomer, then we would know everything and we would know what to target. But like, maybe you actually have to target the specific protein-protein interaction between this part of the protein and this part of the DNA and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my PhD thesis would have been a lot easier to write if it was as simple as, oh yeah, we have a toxic structure and a not toxic structure. That would have been amazing. But unfortunately, it didn't go like that.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, in general, you do find that like when there is the aggregate, then there is toxicity to follow. I think that it could just be the fact that there's so much of this protein that's sort of stuck in that cell that it's not really super functional anymore. Like it's sort of the question as well between toxic gain of function. So a protein actually being toxic and then toxic loss of function. So the protein is sort of sequestering itself, so it can't do its normal role, but it also is sequestering a lot of other proteins into this big clump of like solid protein mass within the cell. So then maybe the cell is not really capable of doing its normal function anymore. So then that would be like a loss of function. So we talk about this a lot in neurodegenerative diseases, and it's again just one of those open questions that we hope one day will be a bit more clear.
Yeah, I always like highlighting all the open questions in the field when we have guest speakers as well, just so that people have like a good idea of where the field is at and what is not known, which I guess is always most things.
Yes, it is good. Most things.
Yeah,
it's difficult because, you know, like aggregation and protein misfolding is such a fundamental of neurodegenerative diseases, but it's still very cloudy as to like what starts that process, why does it start, and like what ways can we actually stop it in, you know, in a real person. So
yeah, I think that's a perfect place to end today's episode. So thank you so much, Estella, for joining us. It's been really, really great chatting to you about your field.
Yeah, no problem. I hope it was understandable and interesting.
Yeah, it was super interesting. Thank you so much for answering all of our probing questions.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, be sure to share with your friends and family and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @neuroverse_pod.
And do check out the website neuroversepod.com for resources.
Thank you for listening.